Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week.
We turn our attention to the markets this week. U.S. CPI numbers reinforcing concerns about inflation.
And the financial stories that shape our world.
A really different reaction to markets. More indications of just how hot the U.S. economy really is.
Through the eyes of the most influential voices.
Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary.
Catherine Keating, CEO of BNY Mellon.
Sam Zell, Chairman and Founder of Equity Group Investment.
Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
Walking and chewing gum at the same time as central banks address the need for financial stability without giving up their battle with inflation. Welcome to Bloomberg Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. This week, special contributor Larry Summers takes us through the Fed decision and what the banking crisis could mean for the real economy.
They need to recognize that regulation lost its way over the last year or two.
Arun Sundarrajan of NYU sorts out the real from the fanciful in ChatGPT.
The more people who use the system early on, the better it becomes.
And a special Wall Street Week roundtable on the banking breakdown, with Larry Summers joining former Fed Governor Dan Tarullo and Stephanie Flanders of Bloomberg Economics.
We know first that there was a significant supervisory failure somewhere along the way.
Central banks already had their hands full fighting inflation, but then a second front opened up with a banking crisis that quickly spread from Silicon Valley to Zurich, where officials began the week announcing that UBS would take over Credit Suisse, a move praised by ECB President Christine Lagarde.
I welcome the swift action and the decisions taken by the Swiss authorities. These actions are instrumental for restoring orderly market conditions and ensuring financial stability.
But it was a shotgun wedding that left holders of so-called cocoa bonds of Credit Suisse out in the cold.
$17 billion of them are now rendered worthless.
All of which put pressure on the Fed to explain how it would pursue price stability and financial stability at the same time. And Wednesday, we got our answer.
Inflation remains too high, and the labor market continues to be very tight. We remain committed to bringing inflation back down to our 2% goal and to keep longer-term inflation expectations well anchored. We will continue to closely monitor conditions in the banking system and are prepared to use all of our tools as needed to keep it safe and sound. My colleagues and I understand the hardship that high inflation is causing, and we remain strongly committed to bringing inflation back down to our 2% goal.
And while global Wall Street was consumed with the stability of the banks and how the central banks would respond, the rest of the world went on as President Xi of China paid a visit to Moscow for a visit with his good friend, Vladimir Putin.
Xi is there to present himself as a responsible stakeholder and a peacemaker to try to further bolster China's reputation on the global stage.
Congress summoned the CEO of TikTok to Capitol Hill for a grilling over his social media phenom.
I would also like to talk about national security concerns that you have raised that we take very, very seriously.
At the end of this challenging week, equities actually held up remarkably well, with the S&P 500 up 1.4%, the NASDAQ up 1.67%, while much of the action was over in bonds, where the yield on the 10-year started the week just over 3.4%, spiked up well over 3.6, to end the week back down at 3.37, just a handful of basis points from where it all started. To help us sort all of this out, we welcome now Dennis DeBuscher. He's founder and president of 22V Research, and Sunal Desai, chief investment officer for fixed income at Franklin Templeton. So welcome, both of you. Great to have you here. So now I'm going to start with you because the action really was largely in bonds. You're our fixed income person. Well, how do you explain how the bond market reacted to the news this week?
So, you know, I wish it was an equity market, equity week, but it is a bond market week, clearly. I'd say the type of volatility we're seeing in the Treasury yield curve, it is very interesting. There is a certain amount, in my mind, dissonance. The bond market is asking, pleading for the Fed to cut rates. However, if I look at what is being priced in by the bond market, the number of rate cuts being priced in, it just doesn't make sense. It only makes sense if you're anticipating a really drastic recession triggered by a massive banking crisis. But if that's the case, then the remainder of the bond market doesn't make much sense. I'm talking about credit markets, for example. We haven't seen spreads blow out. All the action really seems to be driven off market participants being unhappy with the Fed not essentially doing what we've seen the Fed do, frankly, since the global financial crisis, which is use overwhelming force at the first sign of wobbles in any particular piece of the financial sector.
So Dennis, is the equity market basically having a big debate with the bond market right now? Because the bond markets are saying we're going to have cuts this week, this year, even though Jay Powell keeps saying we're not going to have cuts, but the bond market seems to think it is. If really we were, wouldn't that signal something really bad going on, and shouldn't that be hurting equities right now?
You would think theoretically that it should be a pretty big drag on equities. I think one of the reasons why equities aren't reacting is because a lot of what's happening in the bond market could be a hedge against a really bad outcome. And at the end of the day, unless the near-term economic data is falling off a cliff, what it clearly is not doing, lower rates are not going to be terrible for equities until it becomes very obvious that you're going to see significant earning degradation. And so there's some chance that, you know, the banking system gets, or people have a lot more confidence in the banking system. And if that happens, then deposit risk goes away or is significantly reduced. You don't have this drastic tightening of financial conditions or lending standards. And if that were to happen, then the economy can weather it, and maybe even with a lower rate outlook. And that combination at least stabilizes equities until they have a little bit more information. Because again, the earnings outlook is not terrible to start the year, and that's a really important point.
So now the news was not just about what the Fed did or what Jay Powell said this week. We also have this overhang of some confusion, even some fear in parts of the banking industry. Was that reflected in the bond market? Did the bonds react to all of that that was going on?
To some extent, but the reality is, you know, if we, you know, you started off talking about the banking crises. I would almost take issue with the idea that there is a crisis as such, because I would really distinguish what we are seeing today in banks from what we saw when we had a true banking crisis, a financial crisis, say 2007-08. We have to recognize that what we're looking at are banks which, by and large, are extremely solvent. If you look at banks like SVB, for example, the problem was the most fundamental mismatch of duration. We're not looking at deep, strange, unvaluable securities where you can't figure out how much they're worth. You're looking at government treasuries. You're looking at U.S. treasuries. You're looking at mortgage bonds where we know the value of the asset by the minute. So I think that's one thing to keep in mind. Every time I hear about the banking crisis and how this is spreading and there's something catastrophic waiting, I would actually argue that what we heard from Jay Powell, indeed what we heard from Janet Yellen, is broadly on point if they see banks having runs. And remember, in banking, we're in the business, people are in the business in banking of borrowing short and lending long, deposits, fund, loans. It's what banking is. I just think that what they are doing, which is trying to separate out what to do about the banks from interest rates, up to a point, this is a very sensible thing to do.
So, Dennis, whether the banks are in a crisis or not, I guess it matters whether they think they're in a crisis or could go into a crisis, because it really affects their willingness to lend to some corporations, and that could really affect equities.
That is what the problem is for equities over time. And what we don't know is how much of that tightening of lending standards will actually show up over time. No one really knows. Tightening of lending standards is going to be, quote unquote, off the screen. So you're not going to be able to pick it up in the typical type of financial conditions indices that we would normally look at, you know, on a Bloomberg screen. So it's a really unknown, but, you know, we did a search today of Google Trends FDIC insurance, and after a giant spike up, it's come down aggressively. So the broader public is probably not so focused on this as much anymore. I realize we all are on Wall Street, and there's a lot of people in California that are. And so if you get past that risk, which is the deposit flight risk, yes, banks will have tighter lending standards. That might mean that the Fed doesn't have to tighten as much on a go-forward basis. In aggregate, you still have the same outcome, slowing economy, lower inflation, but it doesn't mean a recession in the next 6 months. And if you don't have a recession in the next 6 months, then you have the case for equities to at least be stable and to have a significant bounce back in some of the more cyclical areas of the market.
Sunil Desai. Go ahead, Sunil, please.
No, I was just going to just say to Dennis that, in fact, I've seen so much of talk about how Jay Powell talked about raising rates just 2 days, you know, that rates needed to go up a lot more 2 days before SVB broke. And then we saw that when we saw the new SEPs, the top peak rate is still where it was in December. So essentially what we're seeing is a substitution of higher rates, which would have contracted demand for loans more,
yes,
with tighter lending standards, as you said, which constrains the supply of credit. So overall, I do think it's too premature to assume that we're going to see this massive meltdown of the economy on the back of what we've seen in the past 2 weeks.
Sunil Desai and Dennis Buescher will stay with us, because we're going to turn from what happened this week to what it means over the medium and long term. That's coming up next on Wall Street Week on Bloomberg.
Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at stiefel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stiefel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
I think we have a lot of individual investors who are on the internet buying and selling stocks almost every single day. And as a consequence, their behavior is somewhat different than the traditional institution. And quite frankly, I think the institutions these days are behaving a little bit foolish as well.
That was Roger McNamee, a much younger Roger McNamee, then with Integral Capital Partners on Wall Street Week back in February of 1999, when the number one movie in the country was Message in a Bottle, starring Kevin Costner and Robin Wright. And the number one song, well, that was Angel of Mine by Monica. Sonal Desai of Franklin Templeton and Dennis DeBuscher of 22V Research are still with us. So, Dennis, let's go back to where you left us. Basically, it depends on the time horizon. We were talking about what happened this week. But when you look 6 months out, 12 months out, if you're an equity investor at this point, given all the uncertainty we're facing, what do?
You plan for lower inflation and stocks that benefit from lower inflation, very simply. We spend a lot of time trying to figure out what the Fed is trying to accomplish, and this is an open secret. They want lower aggregate demand to lower inflation. They're going to accomplish that goal one way or the other. Maybe the bank's tightening of lending standard does it for them. If that doesn't do it for them, they're going to tighten a lot. They're going to tighten more to make that happen. And so the net result of that is companies that benefit from lower inflation are going to outperform. And as we see it, the things that will probably do the best in that backdrop are your early cyclicals on a relative basis. That's tech, communications, and discretionary. So that's an area we'd be focused on. Then the main question is, as the economy slows, is it a recession or not? Right. If it's a recession, then more your defensive sectors work. That gets you to the, you know, staples, utilities, et cetera. Right. If it's a mild recession, I think you want to fade defensives. And I think you really need to start thinking about the next cycle, which to me is the most interesting conversation. Are we in, and I know you talked to Larry Summers, are we in a lower savings economy that's going to have consistently higher nominal GDP growth, consistently higher inflation pressure, a Fed that's never really going back to 2, but letting inflation run a little bit above target. And over that longer term, you know, the defensives are going to be extremely unattractive if you're going to have a two-year rate around, quote unquote, these levels for a persistent period of time, Dennis, which is possible in a lower economy.
Dennis, I want to sneak Sonal in here because I want to ask her the same question as a fixed income. Unfortunately, we have just a short period of time. What do you do when you're investing as a fixed income investor?
So right now we're staying up in quality. We've been relatively neutral duration because I think we're going to get a lot more volatility. I do think 10-year rates are going to go back up before we actually start coming down, because right now markets and Fed are playing a game of chicken. I happen to think the Fed's going to win. And so if eventually we get higher yields, and then I think we set ourselves up for a pretty good period for fixed income. We're already there. As we move into a slowdown, which allows the Fed to cut sometime next year.
That is terrific. Thank you so much to both of you. That's Sonal Desai of Franklin Templeton and Dennis DeBuscher of 22V Research. Fed Chair Powell this week said he didn't yet know exactly what went wrong with Silicon Valley Bank, but the Vice Chair Barr was conducting an investigation to find out. We convened our own expert roundtable to discuss what we know at this point, what we don't know, and what changes should be on the table to make sure we don't repeat what we saw over the last 2 weeks. Here's former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, former Fed Board member Jan Tarullo, and Stephanie Flanders, Bloomberg Executive Editor for Economics and Government.
I trust that the largest banks truly are in the much better capital and liquidity position that Jay Powell referred to yesterday during the press conference. We know first that there was a significant supervisory failure somewhere along the way. Was that failure in the San Francisco Fed's inability to identify problems of growth and maturity mismatches and the like early on? Was it the failure of the second San Francisco Fed team to, which did identify some problems, to follow up in a sufficiently robust way? Was it a supervisory failure because of the light touch approach to supervision that the Federal Reserve Board had put in place over the last 4 or 5 years? But I think in the most immediate sense, this is clearly a supervisory failure. Other factors may be uncovered as the Fed's own investigation proceeds.
Larry, let's put you back at the Treasury, or for that matter, at the White House. If you were looking at this situation, what questions would you be asking to make sure you understood the possible ramifications of what we've seen so far in a broader financial context?
Before I answer that hypothetical, let me put a question to my friend Dan. Dan, I've heard it said, and I don't know, that even in 2022, the Fed stress tests that were applied to the largest banks did not include an analysis of the stress from a major interest rate hike. If that's true, that seems kind of bizarre from the point of view of the world of early 2022, when it certainly many people, certainly me on David's show, were emphasizing that there was likely to need to be very substantial increases in interest rates. Can you say something? And if the stress tests weren't considering increases in interest rates, then perhaps the exempting of Silicon Valley Bank from the stress tests was not central to understanding the problem. Can you say something about interest rate hikes and Fed stress tests?
Sure. So first off, I think, Larry, I agree with the statement you made toward the end of your question, which is, if Silicon Valley had been in last year's stress test for real rather than its stress rehearsal, I don't think it would have made much difference for precisely the reason you say, that they weren't stressing the things that were the SVB vulnerabilities. With respect to stress testing generally, over the last 5 or 6 years, the stress test has become eminently predictable, but it follows the basic pattern of the scenario that was developed when we began doing the annual stress test. The scenario, of course, includes a reduction in interest rates because of the hypothesis of a recession and the Fed's reaction. So to some degree, the answer to your question is, like supervision generally, the stress test has become less rigorous over time. And I think, more importantly, it's become too predictable. And the whole purpose of a stress test is that you're trying to stress against the unanticipated, not the anticipated.
Does our entire approach to deposits change given what we've seen? The fact is they're not as sticky as we thought they were.
That's what I was alluding to earlier. I'd like to have a sense of exactly what the deposit profiles of this group of banks is as a whole, because in theory at least, the supervisor should already have been distinguishing among different kinds of uninsured deposits, some of which have always been understood to be eminently runnable, others of which have were thought to be at least somewhat stickier than insured retail deposits. Right. If it turns out that those, and this is what Stephanie, I think, was suggesting, that those middle categories have changed, then we're going to need a change in regulation and not just in supervision.
That was our Wall Street Week roundtable of Larry Summers, Dan Tarullo, and Stephanie Flanders. Coming up, it was a week that called for courage, and we found it in a somewhat unlikely place. That's next on Wall Street Week on Bloomberg.
Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally,
a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA, SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
This is Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. We're joined once again by our very special contributor to Wall Street Week. He is Larry Summers of Harvard. So, Larry, we now have had another week of turmoil, continued turmoil in the banking sector. What are you looking for going forward from our policy leaders in Washington?
I think policy leaders need to be clear and decisive that depositors are not going to lose their money in large banks, in medium-sized banks, or in small banks. They can do that within their existing authorities simply by being clear that in the event of failures, given the highly fevered environment with respect to contagion right now, they are prepared to use systemic risk exemptions to allow the FDIC to pay off depositors with assurance that those funds will come from the banking industry. I think by doing that, they can contain a significant amount of the pressures that we're facing to provide confidence. I think they also need to increase the confidence they are providing in regulation. While it is true that the 2018 Trump-era legal changes were passed by the Congress, were in almost every respect ill-advised, and in important respects were driven by special interest pressure, it is also, I think, clear that they are not the reason why we have had the problems we have had. The problems we have had reflect problems of management in a number of financial institutions and reflect major failures of the supervisory and regulatory paradigm as implemented by the Federal Reserve. In particular, the failure to do a stress test in 2022, when interest rates were clearly on the upwards path, the failure to do any kind of stress test about interest rate increases manifests a misunderstanding of what a major source of risk in the system was. And they need to signal an awareness of duration risk. They need to signal an awareness of solvency as well as liquidity issues in the regulatory paradigm going forward.
Larry, we heard, of course, from the Federal Reserve, and particularly Jay Powell in a news conference this week, in which they did raise the rates again 25 basis points. We're a little more vague on where they go from here. At the same time, the chair said that this was an outlier. Silicon Valley Bank was an outlier. I guess my question to you is, how confident are we, actually, the Fed has their arms around the problem now? Now we know there is the problem with interest rate risk when it comes to SVB. How confident are we that we know that there aren't other SVBs out there?
I think it's pretty clear, looking at a variety of ratios, that SVB and perhaps a couple of other banks were in important respects outliers. But extreme examples tend often in life to point up paradigmatic issues. And as I've been pointing out, a world of high interest rates with digital banking, click of a finger, ability both to move accounts out and to open new accounts is going to be a different kind of world in terms of risk, and it's going to be a different kind of world in terms of what banks can rely on in terms of the stickiness of deposits. And to what extent that's true is something we're likely to learn in the next year or two. That's why I think it's appropriate ahead of the curve to be sending clear signals of assurance with respect to bank deposits, because it is better to err on the side of overdoing it when you're talking about protecting against bank runs than it is to err on the side of underdoing it.
There are profound issues raised about the banking supervision here in the United States, particularly with the stress test. There are also questions being raised over in Europe right now. They had the approach of those AT1 bonds or COCOs that did not hold up so well for Credit Suisse, certainly. And now, as the week has progressed here, we've seen Deutsche Bank come under siege. What questions are being raised about the European approach to protecting the banks?
I think it's important to recognize that, as Christine Lagarde said, there are very important differences both between the way the terms of the Swiss banks are written, AT1s are written, and the way the terms are written in other parts of Europe, and also to recognize that the ECB made clear that they're operating in a different paradigm than the Swiss authorities were. But I think it's also clear that there's going to need to be some fairly systematic rethinking of these contingent capital instruments and how they work and on what occasions they are going to be bailed in and on what occasions they're not. Despite many years of legal discussion, it's clear that there were not sharp and shared understandings in the marketplace. I suspect and hope that the European authorities, with the support of the United States and Secretary Yellen and Chair Powell, will send strong signals of support over the weekend for the European banking system. Because given the scale of European institutions, there are potentially global consequences if problems spread from them.
Larry, we have been understandably really focused on the banking situation, whether in the United States or in Europe. But in the meantime, the war in Ukraine proceeds. You had an op-ed piece in the Washington Post specifically on Russian assets. Take us through what you think would be a good step forward on the economic front as opposed to the military front in Ukraine.
I've been working with former World Bank President Robert Zoellick on this, and with noted policy academic Philip Zelikow, who's a real legal expert. We are going to have to put billions of dollars, probably ultimately over $100 billion, into Ukraine to win the war and then to win the peace. And the question is how that's going to be financed. And we believe there is both precedent, moral right, and appropriateness to the financing coming from the Russian reserve assets that we have frozen. And right now, those assets are frozen, but there is not yet a willingness to deploy them to finance the ongoing support for the economy and the ongoing compensation for damage that Russia has caused to the Ukrainian economy. And we believe that there needs to be appropriate and creative lawyering along with strong political leadership to get past that and to be able to deploy those Russian reserves for that purpose. At a time when we are declaring that President Putin is a war criminal, it seems to me almost inconceivable that we should be stopping short of using what are the currently immobilized assets of his state to deal with the damage that he and the Russians are causing.
Larry, thank you so very much. As a special contributor here on Wall Street Week, he's Larry Summers of Harvard. Coming up, it was a week that called for courage, and we found it in a somewhat unlikely place. That's next on Wall Street Week on Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
Finally, one more thought. One man with courage is a majority. So said Thomas Jefferson. And through the years, we've seen some notable examples of a single person, be it a man or a woman, standing up for what they believe in despite all the odds. Like Army Secretary Joe Welch back in 1954, going toe-to-toe with Senator Joe McCarthy during the Red Scare.
Until this moment, Senator, I think I never really gauged your cruelty or your recklessness.
What you have done and done. Have you no sense about decency, sir?
Or in the 1980s, Johnson & Johnson CEO Jim Burke taking the bold and expensive decision to pull all Tylenol off the shelves across the country until he could be sure of the absolute safety of his product. And that brave student we saw stand up to the tanks in Tiananmen Square in 1989, never to be seen again. Vice President Pence on January 6, 2021, stood up to his boss, President Trump, and a rampaging mob calling for him to be lynched as he insisted on doing his constitutional duty to certify the election of President Biden.
President Trump is wrong. I had no right to overturn the election. The presidency belongs to the American people and the American people alone.
But one area where we haven't seen much courage is in our dealing with our national debt, especially when it comes to how we're going to pay for all that we owe in Social Security and Medicare. Everyone agrees that what we are doing is not sustainable.
There's bipartisan support for Social Security and Medicare. If anything, we need to shore those programs up. They're running out of money.
But when President Biden brought up the subject at the State of the Union address this year, he managed to get Republicans and Democrats to agree that we shouldn't do anything about the problem.
Some Republicans want Medicare and Social Security to sunset. I'm not saying it's a majority.
And he was proud of it.
As we all apparently agree, Social Security and Medicare is off the books now, right? They're not to be stopped. All right. We got unanimity.
This week, though, we did get an example of real courage in addressing an aging population as President Macron of France stood up to his parliament to implement pension reform.
In France, President Emmanuel Macron's government faces two confidence votes as soon as today over his pension reform. Last week, Macron used a constitutional provision to push through the plan to boost the minimum retirement age from 62 to 64. That led to violent protests. Macron's government says the no confidence votes won't get a majority in Parliament.
Financial markets this week have called for more than a little bit of courage. Courage to face the truth, courage not to overreact, courage to remain calm. And so we leave you this week with some further thoughts from John Mack, who led Morgan Stanley through the worst of it in the great financial crisis, and what it took to lead his organization through that time.
I knew if I cracked, they all cracked. So I had to put on a face. What they didn't know, I would shut my office door and just try to pull myself together. I couldn't show the stress or fear that we were under.
That does it for this episode of Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. See you next week.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.